The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 11th of September, 2018. On the podcast today, I have David Sefton, Executive Chairman of Anglo African Oil and Gas, AAOG. And David gives an update on their TLP-103 well on the Tilapia field, where they experience issues during the drilling. Plus, I also have Paul Haywood, Executive Director of Block Energy, BLOE. And Paul discusses the agreed MOU for the hire of drilling and workover rigs to be used on their work programs across their three licenses. Plus, Andy Hollingworth, Chief Executive Officer of Tuple, TOOP, explains what the £2.2 million they've raised will be used for and also gives an update on their recent major contract win. And because it's a Tuesday, Alan Green is here talking about the following companies: Feedback, that's FDBK, Katane Innovations, that's CTEA, Midwich, MIDW, and of course, it wouldn't be Alan with an update on Andalas Energy, ADL. And as always, I have a list of the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see the top 10 of both those lists on the front page of Vox Markets. That's voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is David Sefton, Executive Chairman of Anglo African Oil and Gas, AAOG is ticker. David, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Justin.
Yeah, it's good you came on, because we've obviously had a bit of action a couple of weeks back, and things didn't go quite according to plan. We'll get into that in a bit, and you can tell us where you are now with progress there. Before we do, David, as always, if someone's listening and not familiar with the company or they're brand new to the podcast, how would you summarise Anglo African Oil and Gas?
Well, AAOG is an E&P company which has a principal asset, a field called Tilapia in the Republic of the Congo. It is an existing producer. We currently produce and sell oil. But what makes this interesting is not the existing production. It's that by drilling a new well, TLP-103, which we'll talk about in a moment, the company can or will go through the existing producing layer. We'll add some more production to that. It then goes down into a layer called the Mango Sands. And this horizon is one in which we have wellbore data showing producible hydrocarbons from a test well a few years ago. That should enable us to bring production on stream. Generally, those wells in the Mango come on stream at about 800, 900 barrels a day, then decline to about 500 barrels a day. Just at that point, just bringing in the Mango and R1, R2, we will be, and just from one well, we'd be very cash flow positive at that point. Very cash generative and cash flow positive. Mm-hmm. And we then have a game-changing exploration horizon, which we're targeting after that, in the Genesand, where neighbouring producers like Eni are getting 5,000 barrels of oil per day per well. Mm-hmm. If we hit that, and we know the structure's there, if we hit oil in that part of the structure in our license area, that's a step change in value of the company. So it's an unusual type of E&P company. Like most small E&P companies, it's total loss if the exploration time doesn't come off. But here we've got an existing producing company, we are selling oil, we have proven reserves which we can develop, and on top of that, we have some really high impact explorations.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about that, because on the 5th of September, you experienced what's called a topside issue that affected the rig, and you temporarily suspended operations there. So tell us what happened, David.
Well, it's extremely frustrating. We had the rig in place, and I was very pleased that we'd spudded TLP-103. And then in the early part of last week, the rig itself, so it was sitting above the surface, started to show signs of instability. We put in place the contingency plan we had in place for any issue like that, and we shut down production and tried to figure out what had happened. We now understand that what had happened is that we had encountered in the uppermost layer that we were drilling through. So nowhere near any of the target horizon. But we had gone through quite a wet soil area, which was much more unstable than the geological model had suggested. Now, that's not something that impacts what we expect to find further down, because you can get these variations near the surface. Obviously, we're quite close to the shoreline. That meant that with a pad which had been constructed by the previous owner, who not perhaps the specifications we would want, that was starting to move because of the instability in the uppermost layer, which was obviously causing the rig to move because the rig was sitting on top of the pad. Mm-hmm. We have taken the decision to abandon that and restart. We'd luckily we'd only been going for a few weeks, so while we were several hundred meters down, we weren't anywhere near we were getting towards, but we were not in the first of the target horizon. So I haven't done any damage to the areas that we were targeting, but very frustrating to have to abandon this one and restart.
Yeah. So, take us through now. What is the plan going forward, and how do you sort of make sure this kind of thing won't happen again?
Well, the plan going forward is to respun on a new pad, which is already being constructed, which is about 100 metres away from the old one. We've managed to largely disassemble the rig over the last few days, and then I'd say the operations team work around the clock on this. With no damage that we can see to the rig, we had to cut the string, so we use a new drilling head, but we had that in place already as part of our kind of contingency planning. There's probably looking at about a 25 day delay to go to the new site. So the time cost here, which is very, very frustrating, but we will be drilling again once we get through that time period. How do we make sure it doesn't happen again is the most important thing, isn't it? Because there is no point of just drilling another one in exactly the same way and hoping for the best. So we've had our engineering team, the rig contractor's engineering team, and also an independent third-party engineer that we flew in to look at this, and they all agree both on the cause of the problem and also how to mitigate that going forward. Without getting into the absolute complexity of the engineering, which I'm probably not that qualified to say, but we have to increase the structural integrity and rigidity of the uppermost part of the well. So we're going to do this by having an extended shoe going in there. We're also drilling with casing for the first 100 plus metres. And we will obviously have a much better constructed pad. But there's a draft report I saw last night, which the independent consultant who agrees with the recommendations of the internal engineering team as to the way to deal with this. It's not an unheard of issue, and if we'd known that the uppermost layer was going to be this off, we would have done all these things to begin with. And in that sense, without sort of trying to be too Candidian about it, it will be a better well coming out of this. Also, oddly enough, actually, just that moving 100 metres has solved an odd little engineering issue that we had with Geno, which was we couldn't quite deviate enough from the original site to hit the Geno at the absolute apex of the crest, which is the topmost part that you want to hit for. That 100 metres will enable us to deviate. On the deviation of the well now, we should hit actually on the crest. So, yeah, both on the uppermost side and Geno, it'll be a better well. Yeah. Second time around. I know that's scant comfort when we were looking at being in a position now, being able to talk about using the first horizons. But obviously these things do happen sometimes when you're drilling. But we do have a good plan here. The plan is robust. We won't hit the same issue again. And we're getting on with it very, very quickly.
Yeah, okay. And you mentioned there's obviously a time cost. I mean, talking about financial cost, do you need to do any kind of emergency fundraise to finance this?
No. I mean, there's a cost to this. It's not millions and millions of dollars. We do have contingencies and other things in place, and we are sitting on cash at the moment. So the last thing I'm going to do in a bit of a situation like this is run off and do an emergency placing or something like that. Very, very conscious of the importance of the share price and avoiding dilution of the shareholders. We had always thought, sort of going forward, we would look at bringing some debt into the company, and we're actually working on that for quite some time, because the kind of debt I'd like to bring on board is of a non-toxic variety, which doesn't have the sort of, if you like, death spiral conversions, to use a slightly common phrase about them. So we've got sensible discussions going on with people about putting some debt in place for the company kind of going forward, and it's debt that we can repay with no impact on the capital structure. But frankly, actually, and that's slightly on hold a little bit this week or two, because we're focused on getting things re-spudded. But there will be a cost. We will absorb that cost through the contingencies, which includes debt. And we also have potential offsets for the contractors, and we'll see Nationwide Insurance Company. So there are lots of different reasons for solving the cost of this, which is not that great. What it is not going to do is that we are genuinely not running around the big shareholder at the moment talking about an emergency placing. That isn't happening.
Yeah, okay. And so you say it'll take about 25 days, and you reckon it'll take 64 days to complete. Is that right?
64 days once you get past the 25 days and start drilling again.
Yeah.
So there is a double effect of the delay here. It's not just the 25 days, it's also the days drilling, which we then have to repeat. That's nice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, David, one final thing, as always, if someone's listening to this and they like the sound of the potential here, even though there's been a bit of temporary delay, can you give them the three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please?
Well, I think first of all, it still comes back to the risk reward ratio on the well here. There's not that many wells that get drilled that are as interesting as this, that can add production from an existing station there. Should have further production with a small degree of execution risk in a proven layer, and then also have some exploration upside, which should be utterly transformational. Secondly, we are an existing producer. It's very different from the small E&P companies, where it's a very binary bet on finding oil or going out of business. Yeah, this is a company for which we have great ambitions for. And thirdly, it's a very experienced management team who wanting to remain disciplined cost basis with the economic reward very much tied to the share price. We have to hit that 20p share price for us to start making some cash out of this. So we are very, very, very aligned and focused with the shareholders and doing stuff and stuff.
Marvellous stuff, David. Good to chat to you. Thanks for coming on, and hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, and hopefully with some better views. But thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hayward, Director of Block Energy. BLOE is the ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Justin, thanks for having us.
Marvellous. Well, listen, you haven't been listed long, but you're getting things done. You've signed an MOU. We'll get into the detail of that in a bit to move the project along. Before we do, Paul, as you're newly listed, a lot of people may not have heard of you, so give us a brief summary. What is Block Energy all about, please?
Sure. We're an E&P company, recently listed on AIM, having raised £5 million. We have interest in three production sharing contracts in Georgia. Two of our licenses are currently producing. Three is not, but we're about to take that into its development phase. We've got a very, very busy 3 to 6 months ahead of us, Justin. So, exciting times.
Yeah, and tell us, it's good to put some figures on it. So tell us about some of the licenses and do you have any figures on the resources or reserves there?
Yeah, sure. So we've got just over 1.2 million barrels of P2 oil reserves that have been attributed to our Norio and Saskanesi interests. We've also got a contingent oil resource of over 70 million barrels. And the headline figure for us is just over 600 BCF of gas potential in West Vestavi. And this has been attributed or somewhat underpinned by existing gas discoveries that we've had throughout West Vestavi. We has been established within the license area prior to our ownership.
Yeah. And taking into account and putting that into context, you are sub 10 million market cap, so plenty of potential there. So let's talk through the memorandum of understanding. You've agreed for the hire of drilling and workover rigs. Take us through this detail, if you could, Paul.
Yeah, sure, Justin. So look, leading into the initial phase of our work, I mean, which is all predominantly focused around the drill bit, we've got a recompletions plan for, or I should say repair work plan for our Saskanesi license, which will get the crew and rigs moving and it have an increase in existing production. And then we move across to Norio, whereby we're looking to recomplete up to 8 wells. And then we'll move the team down to West Vestavi, recomplete or prepare for sidetracks 4 to 5 wells, and then sidetrack 2 wells, again, increasing oil production. Now, obviously, a key component to performing that work is, of course, agreeing rig contracts with equipment suppliers. Now, we've done the rounds in Georgia. We've looked throughout the region. We spent time in Azerbaijan and elsewhere negotiating terms, and we've actually managed to agree the principal terms around a lump sum rig contract with Block's largest shareholder, Georgian Oil and Gas. The terms of the agreement basically give us secured exclusive access over the two rigs that are of most importance to our, at least our phase one work program, which is an A50 workover rig, which sits around a 40-minute drive or less, actually, from our Norio oil field, and a ZJ40 rig, which is capable of drilling down to around 4,000 meter depths. The principles of the agreement offer Block up to 12 months, as I said, 12 months exclusive use of both rigs mentioned. We have the opportunity to, the initial phase is 6 months. We have the opportunity to extend post 6 months for another 6 months, hence the 12 months. And I think it's possibly important to give our listeners a small insight on the importance of this particular contract, in that, you know, rig contractors typically offer companies equipment on a daily rate basis, which poses kind of, it offers the company's exposure to pretty intensive risks around cost overruns, etc.
Yeah.
Now, additionally, typically on these daily rate contracts, the sting in the towel is normally found in further standby charges should your program overrun, inter-well rig moves, mob and demob costs, etc., etc. Now, this lump sum agreement that we're currently working through mitigates all of those above charges, in that Block will technically own the equipment for up to 1 year period and therefore not be exposed to the charges mentioned, and most importantly will have secured its equipment up front, mitigating any risks around rig availability for the next 12 months. And I'm sure yourself and I most definitely am aware of situations in the market whereby, you know, companies have been bullish on a start date for a work program. That program's overrun. They've lost rig availability. They've had to demob and remob the rig at a later date, which then triggers cost overruns, et cetera, et cetera. So this lump sum agreement that we're now working through deals with all of those inherent risks around your typical daily rate charges with rig contractors, and puts Block in a fantastic position to execute in its next phase of work.
Yeah, do you know what? Listen, it's almost a kiss of death when a company gives a firm date on something that can, you know, it's quite kind of complex thing, you know, and so many moving parts. So it's always good to be right. Very conservative like you say. So that's a good call. Marvellous, Paul. Well, listen, it's good to see you. So essentially, and it's, we've said it before, but it's worth reiterating, what are your targets here? What are production targets you're looking at?
So immediate production targets, I would expect by the end of this year would be circa cranking existing production up from around 15, 20 barrels of oil a day up to around 250. As mentioned in previous podcasts, we're company break even at $70 oil, with a daily production rate of about 120 barrels of oil a day. So needless to say, 250 barrels of oil, although it doesn't seem like a big number on surface, it pays all of the company's bills and kicks off a bit of free cash flow. When moving down into West Vestavi, the two sidetracks are expected to yield anywhere between circa 600 barrels of oil a day. That'll bring us up to around 850 barrels of oil a day in total. And thereon, we'll move into our phase two development program and actually start drilling new wells, whereby the production target within the next couple of years will be circa 2,000 barrels a day. So assuming this phase of work goes very well, we'll be self-funded. We'll then recycle cash back into future development programs and get on with drilling new wells.
Yeah, I know private investors like that self-funding, phrase. Marvellous stuff. Well, Paul, one final thing to do. If someone's listening, likes the sound of this, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, first and foremost, keep an eye on the rig contracts, final rig contracts, which I hope to be agreed imminently. That's one to watch out for, that's for sure. Mobilising of rigs, getting on with our initial phase of work, lots of excitement around that programme. And most importantly, we're fully funded to complete all of that work. So there's absolutely no reason why I think the market shouldn't be keeping an eye on us.
Marvellous stuff. Paul, like I said, lots going on, so hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Great, Justin. Thanks a lot.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andy Hollingworth, CEO of Tuple. That's T-O-O-P. Andy, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin.
Yeah, and it's been a very interesting few weeks for you. I mean, you've announced several contracts. Your share price has gone bananas off the back of one of them. We'll get into the details of that a bit. And today you've announced a capital raising. We'll go into that. Before we do, Andy, there are always people listening to the podcast who are brand new or not familiar with the company. So can you explain or summarise what is Tuple all about, please?
Yeah, certainly. Tuple PLC is one of the fastest growing business-to-business telecoms companies in the UK. We are built specifically for the small business market, which are small businesses in the UK that have less than 50 employees. We literally specialise in looking after the small business market because there are over 5.5 million of those companies in the UK. They make up the biggest chunk of the UK. We do it directly through an online-first approach, through enhanced digital marketing using social media and digital campaigns and cost comparison sites. Everything is supported by our own proprietary software platform, Merlin, which makes our business scalable and automated. And we have a growing part of our wholesale business as well, which is partners taking the Tuple products and services white labeled and putting them into the market themselves through their own platforms and often through the Merlin platform.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, so you announced today proposed placing to raise £2.2 million. That's a big chunk, isn't it?
It is a good chunk of money. As I say, we've raised £2.2 million. We were actually oversubscribed on the raise, which is really pleasing to see. So we're really happy with today's result.
And tell us what it's going to be used for. And also, I know some of the directors have taken part. But tell us exactly what you're going to use the money for then, Andy.
Yeah, absolutely. Use of funds, over sort of 80% of the use of funds will be to continue to scale our digital marketing, which is resulting in significantly increased sales and conversions, and also provide the working capital through to positive cash flow generation. We see this fundraiser as taking us right the way through to that positive cash flow generation. 15% of the funds will be to continue enhancing the company's service offering. That is absolutely critical when you look at the results of Tuple on independent sites like Trustpilot. Without doubt, we have got one of the top customer satisfaction scores in the market, and we'll continue to enhance the Merlin platform, which communicates with the customer and gives those great results. The reason why that's key is that looks after your future churn and your customer retention, and as well as the growth in sales that we're receiving, it's really important that you look after your customers and give your customers a good experience. And then latterly, we operate in what is a very, very rapidly consolidated market. So we use sort of 5% of those funds to identify future acquisition opportunities that are secretive to our revenue as the market continues to consolidate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's go back to that the contract win. On the 29th of August, you announced a major contract win, which saw the share price in one day to almost 300% increase, which is just goes to show, you know, how significant that contract win was. So take us through the detail of it, if you could, Andy.
Yeah, I think if you look at the if you look at our news flow over the last 2 or 3 months, you can see now a consistent pattern of contract wins in terms of value and size. This one particular contract win at $3.5 million over 3 years was material. It's an independent reseller who have been trading in the UK market for over 15 years. They've seen the Tupor cloud-based telephony platform. They've seen the Tupor next-generation connectivity services, and they signed a contract, which is a 36-month contract, to transfer all their VoIP and cloud telephony over to the Tupor platform, and then additionally using the Tupor white-label broadband and mobile services for all their new orders going forwards. Absolutely key, because in the UK market, BT have entered consultation for the closure of the copper network between 2020 and 2025. So small businesses that use services like ISDN2 and ISDN30 and old telephone systems now know that by 2025 those services won't be supported. Mm-hmm. So people are looking at the opportunities now to move to next generation products. This contract win is an absolutely significant indication that people need to move and people need to do something. So we're really, really pleased. I actually think that we've posted a £3.5 million contract win, and I'm optimistic that the contract at the end of 36 months will be materially worth more than that.
Yeah, and like you did say that, I mean, if you look down your list of RNSs, you've had consistent contract wins, and what's the outlook? I mean, are you still delivering you know, at this kind of speed? Are these contracts, are they looking good?
Certainly the growth in our direct business, which are the customers that we contract directly to Tupor from in the small business market, the growth there is material. If I look at just August as probably one of the softest months in the market, our sales August 2018 versus 2017 was way over 100% order growth. We're now entering the last month of our financial year, and I expect the business to exit on good accelerated revenue growth from our interim stated position. But also, more importantly, I also expect to see a healthy increase in our gross margin. The outlook is really, really positive. You know, we're a number of days into September, and we're already looking at a record month in terms of our direct sales orders for September. Our in-house sales team are converting more sales than we've ever converted before as a comparison to our previous outsource team. But more importantly, and this is, I think, is a key statistic, is when I look at our orders on a monthly basis, now 20% of all our orders are coming from existing customers. That absolutely tells you that we're getting it right. We're getting it right in terms of the customer service and customer experience that we're driving. And as you're starting to increase to 20% of all your orders coming from existing customers, that obviously also gives you a real financial benefit in terms of you're not paying for the cost of acquisition of those orders. And typically, our in-house team are operating about £100,000 a year lower cost base than our outsource model. So you can see more conversions, more sales, and at a lower cost base. And then as the business is scaling, you also see a lower cost base per customer acquisition. So materially, I think we're in really, really good shape. And you can see from the contract wins, the partner side of our business is also starting to scale. So we have two aspects to our business. We have the direct approach and we have the indirect approach, and both are in growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're sounding good. Well, Andy, one final thing to do. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing, but are not yet following the company, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, certainly. And I would say, as of today, we are a well-capitalized business through to positive cash flow generation, number one. Number two, all sales that we do are guaranteed annuity revenue and are typically contracted for a minimum of a 2-year period. So this is a real business that you can touch and feel with guaranteed revenue month on month on month once we've made the sale. And we are now one of the fastest growing business-to-business telecoms companies in the UK market, for sure.
Marvellous stuff. Andy, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch you up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
That's brilliant, Justin. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. You're Al.
Morning, Jess. How are you?
You're good, thanks. Yes, not too bad. And I got of late, my portfolio has been almost like two separate portfolios. Yesterday, some very good gainers, but also some losers. I had 12 losers yesterday, but seven gainers. But the gainers I had, I've got more exposure to them. So I think in gain in sort of monetary terms, I'm doing better. But it's quite volatile. Different parts of the market. Some are taking big hits. Others are doing quite well. You know, it's a bit volatile, isn't it?
Well, yours in two parts, mine's in three parts. I've got a block of energy stocks. Exploration energy. I've got the big stocks, Shell, which I've got a big holding in and just pays a dividend every quarter. I picked that up at £14 a share as well, so that's going well. Rio Tinto, and that's pretty. I've got BP as well, and I've got AstraZeneca, and those are my big four sort of FTSE 100 stocks. So they're all going well. I'm well ahead on all those, and they all pay nice dividends, so you know that's good. But I've also got a block of funds as well, the most successful fund manager bar none at the moment, which is reverberating around the city, are Baillie Gifford, which is still privately owned. Mm-hmm. And their funds are doing fantastically well, and Japanese Smaller Companies Trust. I've got Baillie Gifford Global Change. I've also got the FP Crux European fund as well, and I've also got the Fidelity Technology Fund as well, and all these funds are doing great. And I think it's for a mixed portfolio, tried this and tried that over the years, and I'm hoping, and you know, tomorrow it could all change and everything could blow up in my face, but that seems to be quite a good mix. And then of course at the other end of it, the stocks that we're talking about now, which are the smaller companies, where my plan is basically if I have a penny stock which becomes a 10 bagger, say like an i3 Energy, then I'll take some money out of that and I'll put it into one of the funds, so you know, hopefully the fund will carry on making money, and you know, we grow the portfolio from there. And touch wood, so far for the past couple of years, that seems to have worked quite well.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, let's look at the stocks, individual stocks. What are you looking at?
Okay, first of all, I want to look at Feedback again, FDBK.
I sold my stock.
Yeah, I know. You were saying before the podcast started, I also have run short of patience in some ways with Feedback too, but I still believe firmly in the technology, and also because I know Balaji Ganeshan, he was working at the Sussex Innovation Centre, or still does, and you know, I know Balaji well, so I firmly believe in what they're doing. And of course, we've had the management shenanigans the ups and downs with David Crabb coming, then David Crabb going, and speculation over whether Simon Sturge would come in as CEO, or possibly they'd move Rory Shaw up to CEO. But I mean, nothing's happened yet. But the fact is that Texrad is continuing to sell around the world. They announced yesterday that they'd received an order from the South Korean distributor for the Samsung Medical Center in Seoul, which is obviously pretty prestigious. They recently renewed the contract with Royal Petworth Hospital for Kadran, which is Kadran, of course, it's a picture archiving communication system. They also secured their first GE healthcare order in India. So it's not spectacular progress, but the fact is that the sales network and the distribution network for Texrad is very good and very strong. And to my mind, at some point, if a CEO comes in with different ideas and wants to push the company forward, then there's a great opportunity there to do so. The company is only worth $5 million, and I mean, with that sort of technology and with that sort of distribution network, it would not be unreasonable to assume that valuation could be in the offing of many multiples of that. But clearly, that's just my opinion. I also hold shares in the company too, so I will declare an interest. But I do believe in the mix going forward. And it's either a question of bringing in a CEO to do the job and to take the company forward, or to my mind, if that doesn't happen, if the company rumbles on, then I think it's quite reasonable to expect that one of the bigger players might look at what Feedback are doing, think, well, that's undervalued, look at that network, let's get a piece of that. So anyway, that's it's speculation on my part, but you know, when management can't seem to sort of get things together, as it were, then it's obviously going to leave the shares out in the market undervalued, but with a great network and something that another company could look at and say, well, actually, we've got a similar product, or we've got a product that's complementary to Textrad, perhaps we could plug into that and also take a full advantage of the network that Feedback already have in place.
Yeah, well, I tell you what I sold. I mean, I did double my money on more some on them, and so I took some profit off of it anyway before I sold out yesterday. But I'm just thinking, do you know what? I didn't like the way the CEO went. I thought he was doing a good job, and there was something obviously odd about that. And I don't know what's going on, but I didn't like that. And I think the fact they're not mentioning any of the figures, the revenue, any of their RNSs, says to me they're not big. And because if they are big, they mention it. You know, companies mention it full stop. That's it.
Yes, I mean, of course, yeah.
And in fact, you know, it's they do that. I mean, why wouldn't they? I mean, so I just think it's not material going forward. And I just think revenue generation attraction is taking too long here. And I'm just out. And I don't know, do you know Alistair, the chairman? I don't know what he's like to get on with, but I mean, I just think...
I do.
I just think there's a clash of personalities or something there. But it seems to me, in the short space of time, David Crabb seemed to have structured and done well and organised the company. And I like what he was doing, the noise he was making, he bought stock, and then all of a sudden he's out the door. And I just think, what's going on there? It's really odd, you know, so...
Well, I think Alistair's got a great history with GE Healthcare and Johnson, so he's also very well known and very respected sort of throughout the healthcare industry. So he was actually bought in the first place to ramp up sales and to increase and improve the network, which of course he's very much done. But it could well be a clash of personalities. I don't know, but I think clearly they need to address this at some point and bring a CEO in to take it forward. But at the end of the day, what the company has, the proprietary technology it's got, is extremely good. It's exceptionally good, as evidenced by the huge distribution network the company has. You know, India, China. It's got Boya Digital Technology in Beijing, who are their China distributor. It's got Korea ISG, who are the distributor in Korea, and made the announcement yesterday. And also Tim Irish and Simon Sturgis, just sort of in on the board as well. So you know, that's it's all to play for, and I think it'll just take a bit of news like that to see this company take a big leap forward. Because yeah, the figures ain't spectacular, but it could really be a really good fit for another medical technology company seeking a distribution network with complementary technology.
Marvel stuff. Anything else you're looking at, Al?
Indeed. I want to mention Catalan Innovation. CTEA is the epic code. Formerly Milestone Group. This is a blockchain technology company, but it's blockchain with a difference. It's a high-speed blockchain.
Didn't know you had high-speed blockchain as well as normal. Is the normal blockchain slow?
It is, yeah. 300,000 transactions per second.
Wow.
So Cadnai Innovation have this proprietary technology, and
that's about as fast as you count your cash, Al. I've seen you count your cash very fast.
That's right. I sort of open the wallet and sort of close it in a fraction of a second, and I can rifle through all those notes. it's incredibly fast, and it's fast for a reason. It's incredibly secure, but they're using the technology in a very different way, and they have a number of contracts which they're building and developing. They have a patented technology that they're using with an industry where they're using the technology to monitor the fire doors within buildings and within premises that could be used by insurance companies, and that technology basically registers the checks have been made, and it creates an immutable record, and it goes back to the central database of the insurance company. So it's a great way for record keeping. Obviously, it's a ledger system, as we know, blockchain. But the technology is applied in a number of areas. And I had a long conversation with the chief technology officer there, Alan Simpson, who has a long 30-year plus track record in cryptography, where he worked in both the military and commercial sectors. But he's best known. He pioneered and developed the iPlayer for the BBC, which of course now is a household word. It's a huge piece of technology, and. He and I had a discussion on the podcast, which you can see on the Brand UK website, or just go to Google and Google Brand Communications Cat and I, and you'll see that podcast come up on Audio Boom. He has developed this technology, and he believes that the way Cat and I are using this blockchain technology could potentially be as game changing as the iPlayer further down the road. It's a big claim, but compared to cryptocurrency, which of course is just one application of the blockchain technology, the Cat and I the Cat and I offering can be used across multiple industry sectors, and indeed they've got trial projects running with Aston Villa Football Club, and they also have a joint venture with Trusted Media, which is with music supreme Martin Heath for recording rights and royalty revenues across the music industry. And of course, this can also, Alan explains in the podcast, that it can also be used for digital imaging as well in the same way. So it's an incredibly secure way to regulate and record what takes place in an industry. And Cat and I currently are the only AIM listed company using blockchain technology in that way and generating money from it.
Marvelous.
CTEA.
Oh yeah, CT.
Cup T. Yeah, yeah. If you remember the epic girl, just Cup T, CT. Then certainly the Cat and I have got a great future, and you know it's a very exciting technology. But I urge listeners, if they're interested in this, have a listen to the podcast, because Alan Simpson is a fascinating guy.
All right, getting into the podcast arena. Are you, Al? Got a competitor, have I? Right, I see.
No. Okay. Not at all. No. It's we only run the old podcast, but you know
that's all right. Yeah, maybe you're contractually obliged to only run one a year.
That's it.
Cool. Right. Anything else, Al? Here we go.
Yes, last September we spoke about a company, an audiovisual distribution company called Midwich Group. MIDW is the epic code. Now, Midwich last year were trading at about 380, 380p, 385p, with a valuation of about 250 million. The company have an audiovisual distribution network, large format displays, projectors, digital signage, and so on. And they had a database of 10,000 customers, which they've dramatically increased since last year through the acquisition of Sound Technology, and also Gebroeders van Domburg, which are a Dutch audiovisual company. So they've increased their footprint hugely, and the company have grown dramatically since that time. In fact, today they're trading at £6.35p versus 385p September last year. So anyone who jumped on board or took a punt last year will have done very well from this. But they've announced half year figures today, and I think it just shows that, you know, this company is the period of growth is by no means over. They grew revenue by 25% in the first quarter to 264 million, pre-tax up 48% to just under 12 million. EPS up 61% to 11p, and they've raised the interim dividend by 4.6p, double-digit growth all territories, and the CEO said the full year results are expected to be in line with the upwardly revised expectations announced last time around. So, okay, the company's worth half a billion now, 508 billion. It's trading 635p. It's been as high as 710p on the year, but they've got a large amount of cash at the bank, and I would expect that they will continue to make acquisitions and grow this company at the rate they've been doing to date. So, MIDW is the epic code.
MIDW, and come on, Al, it's, you know, you're on the podcast. As yet, don't think I haven't noticed you haven't mentioned anything about Andlas.
Well, shall we mention Andlas? Okay, I had a very brief phone call with the Andlas board yesterday, and and I just said to to date, Lombardy ODA Fund Management have been selling down.
Yeah.
Yesterday, they increased their stake from 4.8% to 8.9%.
Yeah, I thought that. What's going on here? A change in direction. Yeah. That's very, very rare you see that to a company. Well, you know, changing their mind. So did you get the answers to why?
Well, the answer I got was, okay, so major fund manager like Lombard ODA increases its stake in a 2.5 million market cap company. Go figure. So that was the response. And clearly, I'm not going to go to Zito because we've discussed the Badger prospect, we've discussed the Bunga Mass, but that stake increase, the company increased its stake 5th of September, so that would have taken place just after the Bunga Mass deal was announced. So, you know, I think you can do some math there and come to your own conclusion.
Yeah. Well, I like that. I thought, well, that's interesting. It's very interesting. It did rise a little bit yesterday, but it largely went unnoticed by the market, I thought, because, I just thought very interesting. And, you know, whenever I've been talking about on my videos, I've been talking about, shareholding. The last video I did, Lessons Learned from Investing in Small Caps, is always look at the shareholder register, because I said I used to invest in bigger stocks, I didn't really pay any attention, because you don't need to, really, because they're so big, it doesn't matter. But on small caps, when you're talking like sub 10 million, sub 20 million, it doesn't take a lot to soak up a lot of free float. And so if you check out the share register and you've got the management holding a big chunk, you've got some maybe some high net worths, and then maybe you've got some institutions in there, then there's not a lot of free float. So any demand in the shares, if someone does a little bit of buying on the market and that supply is fixed, then obviously if you've got a tiny free float, it doesn't take a lot to move the share price. So it's always nice to see, some bigger sort of some big money in there to lock in that, that stock, because it's always good. Basically, the smaller the free float, the more beneficial or the more chance it will move on a little bit of demand, So I like that. I like that indeed. Yeah. So,
I think it's very telling. Lombard ODA have obviously been selling down, and then all of a sudden they buy it all back again. So that's got to tell you something, hasn't it? I mean, clearly they're taking a view, but the fact is that they have a significant stake in the company that's worth 2.8 billion market cap at the moment. So, it's that is highly significant by any standards. So yeah, do your own research, though. I am also a shareholder in Andlas, of course, as you know. So there you go.
So am I, yes. So there we are. So lovely stuff, Val. Thanks for that, and we'll chat next week.
Okay, Jess, thanks very much.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At five, Orosur Mining. At four, Brave Bison, BBSN. At three, Eco Atlantic Oil and Gas. At two, Oriole Resources. At one, Andy was on the podcast, it's Tuple. Did a massive fundraise there, committed their market cap, bigger than the market cap. And of course, he says that'll take them through to cash flow positive. They've been on the podcast a lot. They've done a lot of contracts in the last, new contracts, last 6 months. They've done six, plus that major contract they've announced, which is 3.5 million over 3 years, which is big considering there are now, a 3 million market cap with £2 million in cash. So the company is pretty much valued at 1 million. And so it's worth checking out the contracts. And like I say, I did, buy some shares there. I just think they said on the RNS they're going to cash flow positive at this fundraise. So no need to go back to the market. So I think it's a company progressing. And I love tiny market caps. You know that. Okay. Top five most liked RNSs are at five, EcoAtlantic Oil and Gas, CPR on Orindwick Block, offshore Guyana. I can't say that. Orindwick Block. I can't say that. Flying Brands at four, director of shareholding. At three, Botswana Copper Silver Project, environmental approval for A20 Dome Complex Drilling. I assume that is MTR. They never have their company name in their RNS releases. At two, Arc Minerals intersects extensive copper cobalt mineralization. And number one, most liked RNS, came from UK Oil and Gas, which was from late yesterday afternoon, of course. EWT updates Portland and Kimmeridge Oil Discovery. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.